Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. Welcome back. It is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And please, please consider invoking the power of prayer in our process. And that kind of covers what we, I don't like glossing over. Each of those points are really, really important. And I could easily make a half a show, if not an entire show, over why it's now or never, why that debt is fraud, and the power of prayer. So instead of, because we have covered those in shows and shows and shows, I don't want to necessarily be redundant because there's a lot of content to go through. And as a matter of fact, we were just covering the amendments and we kind of went from the fifth. Actually, we covered the second, the third, the fourth in the last show. And then we dove in from the four or the fifth to the seventh. And now we were kind of covering the sixth. And so we've been a little bit all over the place. And we got Tammy back. So, Tammy, you're keeping track of all of this?
Yeah, I'm trying to.
Okay, so is there any questions you might have, wink, wink, nod, nod, that you may want to bring up?
Yeah, so I was asking you, what about, we don't, at least not that I know of, we probably do somewhere in Wyoming that I don't know about, but what about if a camera catches you speeding, and then they say you have to pay this fine?
Uh-huh.
Then what do you, my question was, what do you do about that? Because that's not constitutional. You can't face your accuser.
Right. And so bottom line, in Wyoming, you cannot have justice. And that's, and in every state in this land, you cannot have justice until we, the people, demand our rights be preserved and demand the government be in compliance with the Constitution. Now, when we look at the innocuous, you know, the pain that we go through from this tyranny of, you know, camera enforcements and those types of things, then what basically is happening is the people are sleeping and living with tyranny, because there's a lot more going on than just that. Because look what's happening on our southern border. The only way that we're going to actually come out of this is that we have to get our public servants to actually shed all of this crap that they've allowed to basically creep in. The only reason you're using camera enforcements is because there's a big corporation out there that's making money while they're based. They came to the state, they came to your county, they came to your city and said, how'd you like to make some revenue? And we'll make some money to boot. Yeah. So in other words, they've colluded with your government to basically deny you of your rights and use this form of legal enforcement.
And nobody questioned the constitutionality of it?
You know, and actually there have been places, and as believe it or not, Murrieta, California has actually a long, long time ago won in court the unconstitutionality of camera enforcement. Hmm. But overall, the state has basically wiped that out, and bottom line, the court system, which is completely rigged, and your government, in other words, your representatives have abdicated their role in our Republican form of government because they've empowered the courts. Because when you look at every state in the union, where do the laws come from? Do they actually come from our representatives? No. They may be sourced supposedly by a representative, but 9 times out of 10, the representative sponsors it. It comes from a lobbyist, and that lobbyist actually writes it because your representatives, you know, they're not that smart, or they, you know, don't understand what needs to be done, and they just allow, and got to remember that most of their money is coming from these lobbyists, and so they basically sign off on, or they sponsor these unconstitutional bills. This is how every state in the union has been passing laws that directly violate, like the digital currency bill, how they just allow these things to happen at your expense. So what has to happen? You know, I know people just want to solve one little problem, But why solve one little problem when we can solve the whole kit and caboodle? We have to create a movement. We have to get the counties, the people of the counties, to take a stand and say, we're taking our counties back. And once we do, we're coming for the state. And once we've taken the state back, we're going to start, you know, arousing and waking up the other counties in all the other states. You've got to do this, folks, because if we don't do this, then they will finish their running roughshod over us and hurl us off the precipice into the arms of the global communists. Kind of that simple.
I mean, simple, but it seems insurmountable.
it does seem that. But when we really think about what does it take, do you have to have 100% of the people? No. Do you even need 50% of the people? I don't think so. And as a matter of fact, how many people are in your county, Washka County or whatever? How many people live in that county?
Just over 5,000.
Just over 5,000. So when the county commissioners see a group of people that equate to about 500, that would be 10%.
Mm-hmm.
500 people in, you know, around the county building because they couldn't all fit, but they can hear them outside. In other words, the code, or I should say the plan would be those people that can't make it in have to be the loudest because they want to know what is that noise coming from? That's from outside the people that can't fit because, you know, you can get out there, you can do a head count. But bottom line, when you're actually got 500 people in front of you, it is very intimidating and very overwhelming. And it's one thing to basically be loud. So do you understand the crime of assault and battery?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what is assault?
Touching somebody in an offensive way?
Nope. Assault is threatening them. Battery is touching.
Oh, okay.
Once you've laid hands, that becomes touching. That means battery, whether it is harmful battery or, you know, no harm induced. Because, you know, when a little child hits you, they can't even, you know, they can't even induce a bruise, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, but they're basically engaging in battery. Now, an assault is a direct threat, like I'm going to kill you. But if you say you must do these things or you are in violation of the law, is that assault? No, that's stating a fact.
Right.
Okay. So when you have people demanding compliance to the law, is that assault?
No.
No, it's not. So you're not committing any crime. And so can the people actually go and descend upon your county legislative body, where whatever they meet in the county hall or the county, you know, commissioner's building, whatever you call the building, can they go and descend around that and basically surround it with enough people going into where they still have people that nobody else can get into that building because there's that many people crowding and, you know, nobody gets through until we get our redress of grievances. Because the question is, do we the people have a right to assemble and petition government for the redress of grievances?
Yes, we do.
That goes back to the First Amendment, that right cannot be abridged. That is a superior right of the people to actually have and face our representatives and say, you must act. So if you start understanding the power of the people and we start looking at what does it really take, does it take 10%? Maybe less than that. Maybe it only takes 7%. When people actually start seeing, and actually, when they start seeing the notable people, like when you get businesses that are actually taking a stand, because businesses have the most to lose, especially the ma and pa businesses. And in Wyoming, most of those businesses are what? Ranchers or farmers.
Right.
And so when those farmers, because they see them in the crowd and they go, that person is an influential person. Right? I mean, if you have store owners and these farmers and ranchers, and they see these people who they know, you know, that actually have the clout because they're the ones that are making the money, not the employees or what have you, but the actual people who have really stepped in harm's way by taking on the risk. They're technically, these businesses, these farmers, these ranchers, they are the leaders of the community because they've stepped up and said, I am going to invest and I'm going to employ people so that we can make, you know, this town and this area better.
Mm-hmm.
Right, wrong, or indifferent, we all have this responsibility to lead. Even if you don't have any financial stake in the town, but you understand what needs to be done, you can still lead. Because you can actually start helping people understand those who actually have the affluence or they have the ability to direct these things. We want people to actually start getting involved. So once these people start showing up and your county commissioners see this, they go, oh my gosh, I either have to do what these people want me to do or I'm not going to be a commissioner anymore. Because these people are really fed up and they're pissed off. And I'm telling you, some of the problems that you're facing in your county regarding illegal invaders that are in your county, whether they're working or what have you, that becomes a real problem. When we start looking at, you know, the international law, the vaccinations and all of these things coming from the World Health Organization, so forth and so on, our health freedom. We have petitions that cover most all of the big problems. That would basically say you either get involved. We actually have a geoengineering. There is not one person in America that is not being affected by geoengineering. With the heavy metals they're dropping on us and this other crap, everybody should basically say that stuff has to stop.
Yeah.
So you get people to start looking at this plethora of petitions to say, yes, I'm all on board. I'm all on board for all of this. Now we're actually, because, and I've kind of said this, when we really look at everybody out there, what moves them may be something different than the other person. It may be abortion. It may be, you know, the invasion. It may be, you know, this spending and debt. So the enumerated powers, the, you know, the Department of Transportation, even though they wouldn't think that that would be the petition, but when they read that, they realize, you know, they don't have the authority to spend on all of this stuff. It encapsulates these things. The digital currency bill. We actually have a petition to basically say, you as a state, even though you haven't passed this bill, you need to make an amendment that actually acknowledges the responsibility of the state to not allow anything but gold and silver coin. Because the federal government has basically been dragging us along with this paper fiat currency. So on and so on and so on. And so we need help. We, you know, I know you're working on an amendment regarding spending, or not an amendment, a petition. But my point is that as we create more and more petitions, what'll end up happening? Because when we see 4, 5, 6 petitions come in and they go, wow, we can't refute these. You know, how many more do you really have? Then all we really need to do is lay the color-coded constitution down and say, here's all the violations. Every single one of these violations represents the need of a petition, if not 1, 2, or 3.
Mm.
And so they'll go, oh my gosh, what do we do? Because every petition tells them what to do. They need to create a constitutional committee, not just a committee, but a common law committee, a common law council, a common law convention, a common law assembly. That's what they called them in the Tory Acts. When they brought the people, when the county commissioners, the board of supervisors, used their authority as your representatives and say, we're going to form a common law body of the people. And you can choose whether you want to call it an assembly. You can call it a jury. You're not going to be providing indictments. You're going to be providing declarations and petitions. Declarations being what is the constitutional law of this state or of this county. We're not going to recognize the annotated constitution here. We only recognize the legitimate constitution and its amendments. So in other words, as this county committee or council or assembly starts moving forward, they actually give all of the power necessary to the county legislators to actually start speaking in your behalf. That creates a symbiotic relationship between the people and their representatives so that when your county commissioners, your board of supervisors, doing your will, go to the state house and they say, you are in violation, and the people in our county aren't putting up with it. But that's actually getting ahead of the game. Because when you look, people, please read these petitions. As you go through these petitions, there are 8 steps. The first step is you have to form your county constitution compliance committee, your assembly, your jury, mm-hmm. and it needs to be a large body. It has to be at least 25 people. I recommend having, you know, in the 30s so that you actually have people contributing. They can all vote, but you have to have a vote of at least 25 people for it to be legitimate as a common law voice of the people. And the nice thing is you don't need to have a unanimous decision. You just need to have the majority of the people all agree that the Constitution must be complied to. Those people who actually, so here's the difference between common law under the biblical form of the Britain or the British Empire, when we formed common law assemblies, the Bible actually allowed us latitude. And this is where the real problem came in, because based on interpretation, there was ambiguity. But when we look at common law under the Constitution, where the Constitution is the supreme law, not the Bible, it removes all ambiguity because it's over very specific and defined things. In other words, it's not about interpretation. That interpretation was already formed in that constitutional ratification. In other words, during the ratification debates, they created all the definitions, the terms and definitions of that compact. And therefore, the committee will go through all of these things. That's what you get in the very first part of the first section of expectations. The second section is where the county then takes that petition and they basically create an endorsement letter. And that endorsement letter and that petition gets sent out to every county in that state. So while they're getting their county, you know, going through the definitizing process and canonizing or whatever, you know, basically tying all of these definitions into the Constitution, because that needs to be done, then while they're doing that, all these other counties will be forming their own committees doing the exact same thing. There is no reason why these counties can't start communicating, these committees can't start communicating and basically saying, what did you find for this? Where did you get this? Where did you get that? And start actually helping everybody quickly get on board. In other words, we don't all have to invent the wheel. Right. Once somebody does the equity, all we need is somebody else to go through and cross the T's, dot the I's, and go, yeah, we as we see everything that you've laid out, that is spot on, or you've missed this. So here's another illumination on necessary and proper. And it may actually be an illumination of an anti-federalist. And then the committee that actually did it says, no, Patrick Henry was an anti-federalist, and this definition being provided by Patrick Henry is actually antithetical. It can't be included. That was rejected by the ratification. So this is one of the reasons why there's a necessity of literally, you know, delineating which persons were anti-federalists so that you can't include their testimony. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Because when the state actually said, we accept what the Federalists said, that means wholesale what they said was accepted. All of the anti-federalists, what they said can't be applied in the terms and definitions of that compact. That's how cut and dry this is. That's how simple it is in actually moving forward. And all we have to do, and in the very first committee in this nation that will be formed, the bulk of the work will be done. Because that first committee will go through each of the ratification debates that were heavily contested. And they will actually highlight the anti-federalist comments in red. They will highlight the federalist comments in green. So if it's a red comment, somebody comes along from another county and goes, hey, we found this comment that actually illuminates this idea of the supremacy clause. Oh, no, no, that's an anti-federalist. Sorry, you can't use that.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And so it really creates this what we're talking about is an irrefutable ironclad. This is how it goes forward and how it will be done without any batting of an eye or any question. People will be able to go, oh my gosh, and when you look at how each of the clauses were defined in each of the states, you'll find that they were completely in harmony with each other. There was never this, oh, yeah, no, the government has these back doors of implied powers. That's, you will not find anything like that coming from the Federalists. You'll find that coming from Hamilton in the Federalist Papers, but you won't find that in the Federalist in the ratification debates. Because the ratification debates was a formal process, and everybody was basically under oath of what they were going to say, because they would be held accountable.
Yeah.
Which is why Hamilton basically danced around and used theory and tried not to, he did everything he could to stay away from being ironclad and firm in the ratification debates versus the Federalist Papers, which is why he used such hyperbole in the Federalist Papers. But anyway, so as we look at how you're going to do this, it requires, one, getting the people started, then getting the people to create this committee. And once this committee starts, and once once you actually have that committee and your county or board of supervisors completely on board, then all of a sudden they're going to be doing step two, step three, step four of the expectations. They're going to get all the other counties to be aware of, apprised, and basically endorsing what you're doing and actually trying to help convince them that they need to get on board with this process. I'm going to tell you that in the state of Wyoming, how many counties, if they got this endorsement, they see what's going on, how many counties would actually sidestep that? Especially if the party in the counties started actually saying, hey, did you know that your county supervisors, your board of supervisors, received the endorsement of this? So in other words, as the county chair of the Republican Party, and you're working closely with the county, then all of a sudden you can communicate to all the other chairs and go, by the way, your county supervisor just got this. Go talk to them. Because mm-hmm. you see how you can start pushing things and guiding things to happen. If one hand is talking to the other hand, then all of a sudden things start happening. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I will tell you that the divine hand of providence will actually be so active in this if we start acting and we start applying faith in our actions. It is irrefutable. This will catch like a fire in the landscape and will just literally be blown across the state, the county, the state, and the nation. So Anyway, we're going into a break. We've got a little promo coming up. So, folks, stay tuned, and we'll dive back into the amendments so that we can kind of wrap all of this stuff up. But that was a really good question. We'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. So that was a really good question, but I want to make sure I completely answered it. And so, Tammy, you got to probably unmute yourself.
Yeah, I'm unmuted now.
Yeah, okay. All right. So, and you probably didn't hear me say that, but that was a really good question. But one of the things I say a lot is I tell people to read the petitions, because if you really read, especially that last part, the last four or five pages, where we go through what we expect our public servants to do, not that they're just violating the Constitution, but what do they do about it? And helping them at the county level understand that we have to basically solidify the foundation. The reason we're being dug up and torn up is because we, as the people, are not rooted in the law. We're not standing up and saying, you must comply. We have the ability, we have the power to do this. And the Constitution will not only protect us, but it will serve us as our weapon in the beat-down process of all of these tyrants who want to basically rule us without authority. So, anyway, is there any other question? Because that was a really good question.
I mean, there was a case here so what about things like this? Like, there was a case here where somebody stole a campaign sign. And so somebody called and reported it, and they happened to have video of it because it was near the supermarket. And so they used the video evidence to find the people and...
Okay, so when a person uses video to capture, that's not the same thing as the government putting video up.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Because the video itself is now the new constable. It is now enforcing laws to make sure that you can't.
Oh, okay.
See, we actually have a system that allows you to violate the law if you don't get caught. Now, I'll give you a good case in point. We have a speed limit on our freeway system, and I've driven through Wyoming. And there are places in Wyoming that I could easily go 120 miles an hour and not be driving recklessly, especially during the day where you have such great visibility. It's not like you have forest on all sides of the road where some... you know, deer or antelope could just jump out in front of you, right? So you mm-hmm. actually can exceed the speed limit and still drive safely. So if there's nobody around and you get away with that, but a camera catches you, then all of a sudden now you're being held accountable to a camera. If the state, because there's... One of the things I learned, because my father was in law enforcement, that was one of the first things he kind of did. He was a cop. And he learned as a cop that there are two sides of the law. There's the spirit of the law, and then there is the letter of the law. And what they have done is they just basically tried to live by the letter of the law. When we, the people, create a spirit of the law, do we really want the letter of the law to actually be invoked? In other words, when a person really caused no harm and they've exceeded the speed limit, should they really lose their driver's license when nobody was even being threatened?
So just
because they were joyriding, maybe that should have been, hey, you know, that's a little, but can you really tell that person that they were exceeding the safety standards because the conditions of themselves, in other words, it's a case-by-case basis, right? So you have to actually look at that particular case. You just can't use this broad brush that we say that these are the standards that are safe. Yeah, in a general sense, you can, but when you actually look at when somebody decided to go 120 miles an hour on the freeway, is that actually, in that point in time, in that little stretch that they did that, or the stretch where they did that, were they actually causing a risk to themselves and other people? There was nobody else on the road, and there were no animals on the road, or anything could be harmed. And so they did that, and then they slowed down. Was that not living by the spirit of the law?
Yeah.
Okay. Because the spirit of the law is to be safe. And if you can do it safely, then you can should be able to go any speed you want to go as long as it's safe and doesn't actually cause harm to anybody or create any risks or dangers for other people. And if you're on the road all by yourself, or if you're on the road, it's a two-lane road, you know, a divided highway with two lanes, and there's just one other person and you pass them, I mean, you should be able to safely pass them as long as you're not exceeding a, you know, I mean, you know, they could have easily not seen you and pulled in front of you or changed lanes or something because of a pothole. So, I mean, I understand there are all of these nuances, but when we look at each infraction, we have to look at all of the evidence. But when we live by the letter of the law, we don't do that. And what we've done is we've created a system that gains revenue by enforcing the letter of the law instead of living the spirit of the law.
Yeah.
And we need to restore this concept of allowing the people to live the spirit of the law where they actually do have the freedom of being able to drive safely for themselves and not be constrained by arbitrary settings and thresholds. Okay? I mean, it's important. It's important that when we have enough people on the road, there be thresholds and standards.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, and so we have to change our paradigm to be able to get there, and technically to get there, we really need a more enlightened public. Because I tell you, the real problem I see on the road are these self-anointed traffic controllers where people will come out in front of you and brake check you. And when somebody does that, that right there is an act that is absolutely unsafe. That person should have the full force of the letter of the law thrown at them. Of committing an unsafe act by brake checking trucks? I mean, you should lose your... If you're using your vehicle and you're trying to be a law enforcer in that capacity, because if the whole intent is to safely travel, what you just did violated that whole intent. And so maybe you should lose your driving privileges for a while. Because I think then people will start realizing, you know, I shouldn't actually be trying to get people to live to not live the spirit of the law and to make them live the letter of the law. Therefore, I need to, allow people to make their mistakes. In other words, be more liberal or have more liberty on the road. Because I honestly believe governments should actually be allowing and helping promote pushing the envelope of transportation. If you can get from point A to point B in less time so that you are on your way to work, and instead of spending an hour, you can do it in 20 minutes, that gives you 40 more minutes of productivity because you're not being totally productive driving to work. That's the overhead of your productivity. It's the added cost, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's the same thing with, you know, you got to eat. Well, do you need a whole hour to eat? Most people don't take a whole hour to eat. Do you need that? If you want to be more productive, see, the union gets people to say you got to take a whole hour. And, hey, you don't work harder. You don't make the rest of us look bad, buddy. That is antithetical to the type of spirit of an enlightened society where we're all... We all should be seeking to be as productive as possible.
Right.
Anyway, okay, so I'm done preaching, but we didn't cover the last part of this. So a person also has the right to compel people and to basically compel people to become a witness and to basically testify in their favor. Because, see, if you're a criminal, I don't want to get involved. But they actually can prove that you weren't there. You can actually get them to, you know, say that you didn't do it. This other guy did it. This guy that's associated to the mob guy killed you. You were being set up. And so the Constitution also protects the victim or the person being charged with the crime to be able to compel witnesses to actually come in to speak and testify in your favor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the Sixth Amendment also basically guarantees that you will have assistance of counsel for your defense, which is basically public attorney or what have you, right? A public defender.
Right.
Okay, so, and for the most part, that usually happens. You may not get the best, you know, attorney, but at least you have the assistance. So here comes the next amendment, which speaks to what we just spent a lot of time talking about. Go ahead. The Eighth Amendment.
I was going to say the eighth one. Let me find it. Excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted.
Okay. So when we look at the spirit of the law, and when somebody's driving at 140, 200 miles an hour on a straightaway out in the plain states of South Dakota, Wyoming, or what have you, and they come and they take your car, is that excessive when you didn't harm anything? Your car is functioning perfectly.
I would believe so. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, there you go. So, in other words, the Eighth Amendment protects us from their heavy-handed tactics. Not only does it do that, but let's put it this way. Let's say you...
I mean, the only thought that came to my head when we read that, though, is define unusual.
Well, so we can get into that. But that's the last part of this. But the first part, which is yellow, is excessive fines be imposed. So let me ask you this. Let's say you're a young man or, you know, a young woman, and you're just, you know, getting out. You've just got your college. You haven't gotten married yet, and you're in your first job. And so you've got a little bit of debt or what have you. You're just scraping to make ends meet, but the rest of your life is right in front of you. You have some friends come over, and or you go out and meet some friends, and you decide to get a little imbibed, and you have something to drink. And as you get pulled over, or you hit a sobriety stop, and even though you weren't doing anything, you get nailed with a drunk driving. In other words, driving under the influence. Because they have you step out, you know, everybody's stepping out and blowing through the thing. Oh, you're driving with a level of intoxication that is illegal. So they give you a bail of $100,000. That's more than you even make in your first year salary, that you cannot even, you know, come up with that money. And then next to you, the other person that blew that same, you know, they were maybe even more drunk, but they still violated the law driving under the influence. And that person happened to be, you know, a Major League Baseball player, same age as you. But that person, because they're a performer in a music band making good money, in other words, $100,000 is nothing.
Right.
Do you believe that the process of the way we impose a fine for a person making it equal, do you think that is equal?
No.
It's not. Having a flat rate basically makes it untenable for the middle class and the lower class or the lower income people. Instead, our fines and bail should be set based on your income taxes, your wages, what you're making. So the question should be, if a person gets pulled over and they're driving intoxicated in the state of Wyoming, do we fine them for their bail to be 100% of their yearly income? Then that baseball player would pay $5 million for their bail. And you would pay $70,000 because that's what your salary is.
Still seems excessive.
It still seems excessive, but see, that's what the state really wants to make drunk driving, you know, if you put a high penalty to it, then it actually creates a deterrent that people won't do it, right?
Maybe, except for they don't know the law, and so they do it anyway.
I'm going to tell you that it becomes very common that people start understanding these things. But I'm telling you that it becomes only excessive to the poor and the middle class, the lower middle class, than it does to everybody else. The judge or the attorney or the people that are making a lot of money, that's nothing.
Yeah.
Right. In other words, it is not the same imposition to them as it was to somebody else that did the exact same thing, maybe even didn't do it as bad as that person.
Yeah.
That's my point. So this is where we have this legal system of imposing bails and fines and these types of things that are not equitable at all. Now, yeah, I believe
most laws have like a minimum... They have a minimum.
Correct. Like if you commit murder or if you're drunk driving, it has a minimum. So in other words, that minimum shouldn't be based on, you know, a set dollar. That minimum should be based on the individual's income.
Right.
And I say that we do half a person's annual salary or a whole salary. You know, 3 years salary. If somebody murders somebody or rapes somebody, then I believe that they should be very stiff.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what it does, because we actually have a system today that committing a crime, if you're affluent, don't worry about it. It shouldn't be arbitrary, and it should be equitable, to where regardless of the person that committed the crime, they feel the same level of pain as the person with the least amount of money or the least involved. Now, if you're indigent, if you're a homeless person, then you should be remanded because bottom line, a person that has done nothing to make, you know, to create value to their life, then I hate to say this, but... Because we start using broad brushes. When I use broad brushes, I get a lot of feedback. So when we have people, regardless of what the circumstances are, you know, then we need to actually look. It's one thing if that person has a long-term, you know, they're a homeless person. We need to come up with a way to actually dive into the weeds to say this person lost their job. Unfortunately, they're living out of their car because of their circumstances, but they're trying to get a job. And this is where I think the testimony of a priest or somebody that, you know, can speak in your behalf to say, yeah, this person's just in a bad circumstances. He shouldn't be remanded. But if it's a person that has made the choice of living and taking drugs and living on the streets and actually not taking on any civil responsibility of contributing and providing for the community, then, okay, that person should be remanded. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a way we can go down this path. I'm not trying to be king here, but I think we need to look at things like this because not all people are playing the game in an equitable form. There are people out there gaming this, and there are people out there just doing things. And I honestly think that we need to start really looking at how can we approach this in an enlightened way to actually help, you know, promote discipline amongst our society so that people choose to, you know, abstain from that type of behavior, choose to stay away from taking on such financial risk that would cost, you know, them some severe penalties, you know, crime or what have you. We need to promote what I would say is enlightenment in society. We have to do everything we possibly can, which means discipline as well. So those people who choose not to, they want to be the leech, they want to be the parasite in our society, then they shouldn't necessarily be given the same opportunities. Does that make sense? Now,
yeah.
It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be trying to say, please, you know, change your life. You know, the prodigal son was the prodigal son. And until the prodigal son made a decision not to live with the pigs anymore, then they finally took action to actually do things. That's when we really support them. We can't support them in living in their squalor. We have to basically make appeals to them and say, you need, and this, I'm just telling you that we send all of the wrong messages. We're not doing, as a society, we're not doing what's right.
Right.
And by enabling bad behavior and saying, oh, we're going to create these encampments, we got to tax you more money, because all it does is it increases homelessness. Anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway, so now the last part of this, nor cruel and unusual punishments be inflicted. So that there are standards of the type of punishment. Now, here's the thing. People say, well, that would mean that capital offense is cruel and unusual, or sending somebody to jail for going bankrupt, for not being able to pay their debt, would be cruel for that type of crime. Now, mm-hmm. Let's look at the Framers' day. Did they have debtor's prison? You betcha.
They did.
When did they apply the capital offense? Now, these people were talking about cruel and unusual punishment. When somebody stole a horse, what was the punishment?
I don't know.
Hanging. You'd
that's
be hanged.
That's what I was going to say. Wasn't it hanging?
Yes, hanging. Capital. That's a capital offense. You steal something of significance, you're to be hanged. So, in other words, in society, they literally set messages to basically say, this is tolerable. You go beyond this line, you will severely pay with your life. So when somebody decides to make that decision to actually cross that line, they know that, you know, it's going to cost them their life, period. So when you actually have a society that sets these principles, it's one thing to challenge that line, but you shouldn't cross that line.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, anyway, the cruel and unusual punishment to be inflicted was to basically, you know, put them in conditions that they would just constantly suffer, like living with pigs or living in squalor, giving them three cots, you know, three meals in a cot, you know, keeping them a little warm, but not giving them cable television. That's not cruel and unusual punishment if they don't have entertainment. Denying them entertainment is not cruel and unusual. Giving them entertainment is enabling bad behavior. Punishment is punishment. And giving them a condition in a society, or I should say a condition where they pay their crime, they do their time for their crime, to actually be an endurance of a hardship does not actually violate the cruel and unusual punishment.
Yeah.
Okay. But we as a society become so soft that we've actually changed the, you know, the standards to where we're endorsing these, I'll just say this bad behavior, giving people, you know, very little pause to say, why not do that? I mean, what's the punishment? Shoot. As a matter of fact, many people say, I'm better off committing the crime than, you know, than anything else, because at least I have I got good meals, I got a place to stay, I've got TV, you know, it's not bad. I have my own room, you know, instead of living on the street, that's a lot better.
Yeah.
Okay. So in other words, it's not punishment anymore.
Right.
So putting people in communal, you know, jails or in communal environments. I remember when I was in the Marine Corps and when we, you know, went to the bathroom, we didn't have stalls. In other words, you didn't have this little place of privacy. When you sat down on the commode, you were staring at everybody else sitting on the commode. And so was that cruel and unusual punishment?
To women, it would be.
I'm just telling you that, you know, they didn't have to afford the privacy.
Right.
Because, you know, when you think about it, when you're in war and you're out in the field and the battlefield and you got to do it, you got to do it. And you don't have a stall. You don't, you know, go into the room and lock it. You don't have those privileges. You know, you got to do what you got to do. And so anyway, they start drilling that into your head that you are now in a working environment that actually changes civility to something at a different level. So anyway, let's go into the Ninth Amendment, because actually we got 1 minute left. So the Ninth Amendment is pretty quick and easy. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. So in other words, even though there may be an enumeration that actually, you know, can basically identify certain rights that they can take away from you, it can't be construed that you can be denied those things. In other words, they don't have the ability to actually take away our inalienable rights, the right of life, the right of property. So in other words, when you actually have a property tax and somebody loses their home because they couldn't pay property tax, because that was an enumerated power for the state to do that, technically that violates the Ninth Amendment. Now, we got to go because the show's over. But folks, when we come back, I know Tammy will have other questions. We're going to dive into the 10th Amendment, and then I will lay that question for her out of all of the amendments, which is the most important to her, because it's subjective, but we're trying to give you all the facts, and this is why the Constitution is so paramount in understanding this. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process,
process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.